Welcome to the deep dive. So I want you to picture a really familiar scenario. Like you've finally decided to upgrade your computer, right?
Oh yeah, a classic weekend project.
Exactly. So you buy this sleek new stick of RAM to, snap right into your motherboard.
Yeah.
And maybe you also splurge on this massive new graphics card packed with its own VRAM.
Right. Which usually costs a fortune these days.
It really does. But here's the thing. If you just read the side of the box, they sound like they perform the exact same job. I mean, they're both memory.
Yeah, they both literally just sit there buffering data for the processors.
Right. But if you actually put their spec sheets side by side, it is genuinely wild.
Right.
I mean, they look like they were engineered on completely alien planets.
Oh, totally. The numbers just don't align at all. The physical architectures don't align. And even the acronyms seem to be speaking entirely different languages.
Yeah.
Which leaves a lot of people wondering what they're actually paying for when they buy these things.
Which is exactly why we are doing this today. Because the whole premise of our show is taking a stack of complex sources and, extracting the most important nuggets of knowledge. Basically giving you a shortcut to being well-informed.
Right, doing the heavy lifting for you.
Exactly. So today, our mission involves pulling apart this really fascinating piece from the Taming Electrons and Light series.
Which the author actually compiled from some incredible hardware explainer videos by the creator, Red Knot.
Yeah, those videos are amazing. So we are going to explore how main memory, like your standard RAM and video memory, actually started out in the exact same family.
Mm-hmm.
And then why they underwent this massive fundamental divorce and how their divergent evolution perfectly explains the modern AI boom we are living through right now. Okay, well, let's unpack this. Okay. So before we dive into why RAM and VRAM split, we really have to look at their shared DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Because beneath all the flashy marketing terms, they're both essentially DRAM.
Right, DRAM, dynamic random access memory. And if you zoom all the way in on DRAM, like down to the microscopic level on the silicon, what you find is just elegantly simple.
Yeah.
The most basic memory cell, the literal thing holding your data, is made of just two microscopic components.
Okay.
One capacitor and one transistor.
So walk us through how those two actually store a piece of information. Because, I mean, holding an entire digital photo in a single capacitor sounds a bit like magic.
It does, yeah. So the capacitor is what actually holds the data. You can think of it as like a microscopic battery.
Okay, a battery.
Right. If it's charged up with a certain amount of electrons, the computer system reads that voltage as a one.
And if the capacitor is empty?
The system reads it as a zero. It's really that simple. String millions of those ones and zeros together, and you have your digital photo.
That's incredible.
But here's the catch. You can't just wire a microscopic battery directly into a massive electronic circuit.
Because of the electrical interference.
Exactly. If you did, it would just leak its charge everywhere and completely scramble all the neighboring signals.
Ah, so it needs a gatekeeper. Like something to hold the charge in until the processor actually asks for it.
Spot on. That is the transistor's job. The transistor acts as a literal physical gate.
Okay.
When the transistor is turned on, the capacitor is allowed to, talk to the rest of the circuit and share its one or zero.
Right.
And when the transistor is turned off, the capacitor has to just sit quietly in total isolation.
So one capacitor, one transistor. That forms your fundamental memory cell.
Yep, exactly. But the problem is that this elegant design carries a pretty fatal physical flaw.
Right. I remember reading about this in the source material. And it completely shifted how I view the hardware sitting on my desk. The flaw is that the capacitor leaks, right?
Yeah, it leaks. It's an incredibly imperfect container.
Wow.
The voltage just slowly drains away into the surrounding silicon. So a solid, fully charged one will slowly decay into a completely empty zero just by sitting there for like a fraction of a second.
Which is terrible for storing data.
It's disastrous.
Yeah.
To prevent the computer from completely losing its mind and forgetting everything it's holding, the DRAM has to do this crazy maintenance routine.
Right.
It has to systematically read every single cell and then rewrite it back to full charge on this super rigid schedule.
The source called this frantic refilling process the refresh, right?
Yes, the refresh.
Wait, so memory isn't like a permanent locked vault. It's more like a leaky bucket, and the system is just frantically running around with a hose refilling the bucket so it doesn't forget if it's holding a one or a zero. No wonder it struggles to keep up.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. It's this exhausting, continuous process happening millions of times a second.
Millions of times.
Yeah. Reading and writing data is already a delicate procedure, but the fact that DDRAM has to drop whatever it's doing to just refresh itself constantly?
Yeah.
Well, that is the fundamental reason why memory is always inherently slower than the processor it serves.
That makes so much sense. Now, in the early days of computing, video memory was literally just main memory, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Graphics card makers simply went to the shelf, bought standard DDR memory, and just wired it up to their graphics chips.
So the leaky buckets were pulling double duty for the whole system.
They were, and, you know, that worked perfectly fine for a while. Until early graphics processors, the GPUs started getting incredibly hungry for data.
Right, the early 3D era.
Exactly. The standard DDR memory just could not feed data to them fast enough to render those complex 3D environments.
It just choked.
Yeah, so the heavyweights of the era, mainly NVIDIA and ATI, they eventually had to fork off a completely new standard. They called it GDDR.
With the G standing for graphics, naturally.
Right. You got it.
So the transition from 2D sprites to 3D games definitely explains the hunger. But it really begs the question of why standard memory worked beautifully for the CPU, but then completely choked when forced to work with the GPU.
Well, it comes down to the fundamentally different temperaments of the two processors.
Okay, tell me more about that.
A CPU and a GPU approach computing in completely opposite ways. Like, they don't even speak the same language when it comes to work.
Okay, let's examine the CPU first. So the central processing unit is essentially the brain of the computer, right?
Right. And a CPU has very few physical cores, maybe 4, 8, or 16 on a high-end consumer chip.
Which isn't a lot.
It's not. But every single one of those cores is mighty. It is designed to execute incredibly complex serial work.
Serial work, like step by step.
Exactly. Think of a mathematical task where you are summing the numbers 1 through 100.
Right. I can't add 50 and 51 until I know the result of all the operations that came before them.
Exactly. Every single step relies entirely on the result of the previous step.
Yeah.
You cannot split that job up among 99 different cores to do it all at once.
It physically has to be computed one sequential step at a time.
Yes. The CPU pulls the first number from memory, executes the math, and writes it back. Then it asks for the second number, executes the math, and writes it back.
So it makes one solitary trip to the memory at a time?
Yeah.
Exactly. One trip at a time.
Yeah.
But the GPU operates under a completely different philosophy.
Right.
A GPU doesn't have four cores. It has thousands of physical cores.
Thousands.
Thousands. But each individual core is actually quite weak compared to a mighty CPU core.
Okay.
Because the GPU is designed for parallel work. A classic example is brightening a dark, high-resolution photograph.
Because every individual pixel in that photo needs its color value adjusted.
Right. And adjusting pixel number 5,000 does not rely on the mathematical result of pixel number 4,000.
They are totally independent tasks.
Completely independent.
Yeah.
So the GPU's controller doesn't process them sequentially. It hands out the work to thousands of cores at the exact same time.
Wow.
It assigns one pixel to every core, and on a single command, all of those tiny cores dash to the memory to grab their specific pixel.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they all compute the brighter color simultaneously, and they all write it back to memory together. Okay, so the CPU is carrying water one bucket at a time, but the GPU is 1,000 soldiers marching in lockstep. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Because 1,000 soldiers all arriving at the same memory bank at the exact same millisecond, that creates an unimaginable traffic jam.
A massive bottleneck.
Right. So the memory architecture has to physically handle that simultaneous surge of requests.
Which brings us to the ultimate obsession of video memory, bandwidth.
Bandwidth, yeah.
Because the GPU demands everything all at once, it requires an astronomical amount of bandwidth to prevent those thousands of cores from starving.
And Redknot has this brilliant analogy in the source material to explain how VRAM physically achieves this bandwidth.
Mm.
He frames the whole concept as shipping freight between two cities.
It's a great analogy. Moving more data is exactly like moving more freight. And you essentially have two main variables to play with here.
Okay, what's the first one?
First, there's the bus width. In our freight analogy, bus width is how many physical roads you build between the processor and the memory.
Right.
Second, there's the transfer rate. That is how fast the individual trucks are driving on those roads.
Okay, so if bandwidth is just a math equation of roads and trucks,
yeah.
How wide are the roads on a standard motherboard, like for normal RAM?
Well, your standard stick of RAM is pretty much stuck on a 64-bit road.
64-bit.
Yeah. I mean, if you utilize dual-channel memory, you can expand that to a 128-bit road. But VRAM, on the other hand, builds massive sprawling highways.
How massive.
Well, the RTX 4090 graphics card uses a 384-bit bus, and the upcoming 5090 architecture, it's expected to use a flat 512-bit bus.
512 lanes of traffic compared to 64. I mean, tracing 512 microscopic copper lines on a printed circuit board must require a massive amount of physical real estate.
It really does. And that's actually the problem. Eventually, you simply run out of physical space on the circuit board to build more roads.
Right, things can only get so small.
Exactly. The pins on the processor can only get so small. So once you max out the roads, you have to look at the second variable, the transfer rate.
How fast the data trucks are driving.
Right. But we run into a hard physics problem here.
Right, because electronic signals are already traveling near the speed of light. You can't just press the gas pedal harder and tell the electrons to, break the laws of physics.
Exactly. You can't beat light speed. So engineers had to get exceptionally clever. If the trucks cannot drive any faster, you have to cram more trucks into the empty gaps between them.
Oh, that makes sense.
It all revolves around the clock cycle of the computer, which is that internal electrical metronome keeping the beat of the system.
Tick, tick, tick.
Right. In traditional circuits, you had one transfer of data per clock cycle, one beat, one truck. That was called SDR, or single data rate.
Which I imagine quickly became a bottleneck.
It did. So hardware designers figured out how to trigger a data transfer on both the rising edge of the clock signal and the falling edge.
Oh, so hitting it twice per beat.
Exactly. Suddenly, they were sending two transfers per cycle. That became DDR double data rate.
Which is the baseline technology giving your standard main memory its name today, right?
Yeah.
DDR4, DDR5.
That's the one. But the problem was the GPU soldiers were still starving for data.
Because even double the trucks wasn't enough for the graphics card.
Not even close. So VRAM engineers pushed the envelope much further. GDDR5 manipulated the clock signal into four offset phases, allowing it to transfer data four times per cycle.
Wow.
And then GDDR6 doubled that again to eight separate transfers per cycle.
Eight trucks occupying the exact same time window that used to hold one.
It's pretty wild.
It is. But the source mentions that eventually, even cramming more trucks into the gaps wasn't enough to feed the GPU. They actually had to change the cargo capacity of the trucks themselves.
Yeah, that was the next logical step.
Right.
When you can't add more physical roads and you can't fit any more trucks on those roads, you force each truck to carry double the cargo.
But how?
Well, traditionally, an electronic signal was binary. High voltage meant a one, low voltage meant a zero.
Just two clear levels.
Right. But to carry more data, engineers introduced a modulation technique called PAM4.
Okay, I have to ask, how does a single electrical pulse carry more than a single one or zero?
It's actually genius. Instead of just a simple high and low, PAM4 slices the analog wave amplitude into four distinct voltage margins.
Four
Yeah,
margins.
let's say 0 volts, 0.33 volts, 0.66 volts, and 1 volt.
Okay, I'm following.
By having four distinct levels, a single pulse can represent two bits of data at the exact same time.
Oh.
Yeah. Depending on the specific voltage, that single pulse transmits a 0,0, a 0,1, a 10, or 11.
So they essentially stack the cargo double high on the truck.
Exactly. GDDR6X memory uses PAM4, which effectively doubles the transfer rate again to an incredible 16 transfers per clock cycle.
That is just ridiculous speed.
Yeah.
But Redknot gives a really vivid warning here about pushing these margins too far. He says if you take too big a step, you, quote, split your pants.
Yeah, which is a very real crisis in electrical engineering.
Really?
Oh, yeah. PM4 was incredibly aggressive. Distinguishing between four tiny voltage levels traveling near the speed of light makes the signal highly vulnerable to electrical noise.
Because the margins are so incredibly thin.
Right. A tiny bit of interference from a neighboring wire can accidentally bump a 0.33 volt signal up to, say, 0.4 volts.
And then the receiver gets confused.
Exactly. It reads the wrong binary code and the entire data packet is corrupted.
Wow.
It was so difficult to stabilize that for the newest generation, GDDR7, the engineers actually had to retreat.
They went backwards.
They did. They backed off to a steadier three-level system called PAM3. They realized they had basically pushed the physical analog limits of copper wiring just a bit too far.
That is fascinating. Okay, wait, I have a question though.
Sure.
If VRAM is out here building 512-lane highways, cramming eight trucks into every clock cycle, and inventing crazy multi-level analog cargo systems, Why is standard RAM sitting there forever stuck on a 64-bit road? I mean, every generation they just seem to nudge the frequency up a tiny bit. Is main memory just lazy?
What's fascinating here is that it's not laziness at all.
Oh.
It's because CPUs and GPUs evolved to solve completely opposite bottlenecks.
Wait, so none of those massive bandwidth tricks would actually speed up the CPU?
Not in the slightest.
Really?
Think back to the CPU's temporal we talked about. It executes serial work step by step.
Right.
It pulls a tiny amount of data, performs a complex calculation, and only then asks for the next piece. So it doesn't need a 512-lane highway because it's only sending one single truck at a time anyway.
That makes perfect sense.
That's how.
So what does a CPU care about then?
What a CPU desperately cares about is latency.
Latency being the literal time gap between asking for a piece of data and actually receiving it.
Exactly. Because the CPU is constantly waiting on that single piece of data to execute its next step, latency piles up fast.
Like it just physically sits there doing nothing while it waits.
Right. Main memory latency is usually between 50 and 80 nanoseconds.
Which to a human sounds instantaneous.
Sure. But to a processor executing billions of calculations a second, 80 nanoseconds is agonizingly slow. It's so slow, in fact, that CPU designers are forced to bolt smaller, ultra-fast memory, called cache, directly onto the CPU chip itself.
Just to avoid making trips to the main memory as much as possible.
Exactly. The trip to main memory just takes too long.
Okay, so then how does the GPU deal with that same 80 nanosecond delay? Because surely that's bad for the GPU, too.
You'd think so, but a GPU literally does not care about latency.
That sounds counterintuitive for a high-performance component.
It really does, but it all comes back to the thousands of soldiers marching in lockstep.
Oh, right.
Since all the cores fetch their data at the exact same time, a longer wait doesn't pile up sequentially. They all just wait together.
Oh, this brings up Rednaught's analogy about the 45 classmates. I remember teachers using this exact guilt trip in grade school.
Oh, the classic teacher guilt.
Right. If you talk and waste 1 minute of class time, you've wasted 1 minute for all 45 classmates, so you just wasted 45 minutes of learning.
Yeah, and every student inherently knows that logic is deeply flawed.
It is. Time doesn't multiply like that. It's just 1 minute.
Exactly. And for the GPU, even if it has 10,000 cores waiting, it's still just one single delay.
Right.
Because they wait together, a VRAM latency of over 200 nanoseconds is perfectly fine. The GPU gladly traded away low latency to pay for all those massive bandwidth tricks we talked about.
It makes the divorce between the two technologies perfectly logical. But we have to address the new elephant in the room here.
Let's do it.
We've seen how wide VRAM highways can get for gaming. But recently, there has been an explosive rise in artificial intelligence.
Massive explosion.
And training large language models requires data appetites that even a 512-lane graphics highway cannot possibly feed.
No, AI is an entirely different paradigm. Training those models requires moving almost incomprehensible amounts of data simultaneously.
So the normal VRAM wasn't enough?
Not even close. They needed bus widths that traditional VRAM architecture simply couldn't support.
Enter a new acronym, right? HBM or high bandwidth memory.
Yeah, HBM. Now, remember how a regular DDR7 chip might be 32 bits wide? Well, a single stack of HBM3E memory starts at an astonishing 1,024 bits.
1,024 lanes of traffic. That is insane.
And that is strictly for the data. You still need physical wires for the power lines, the clock signals, and the address lines.
So how many is that in total?
A single HBM stack requires close to 4,000 physical wires connecting it directly to the processor.
Wait, how do you even physically manufacture that? I mean, fanning out 4,000 individual copper traces on a standard fiberglass motherboard, wouldn't that cause so much signal interference? They would just be shouting over each other.
You're exactly right. It physically cannot be done horizontally on a standard fiberglass substrate. It just doesn't work.
So how do they fix it?
To solve this, engineers had to completely abandon the traditional circuit board for the memory connection. Instead, they swap in something called a silicon interposer.
A silicon interposer?
Yeah.
How does that solve the interference problem?
It's basically a foundational slab of pure silicon that has been polished smoother than a mirror. It's incredible. It allows for microscopically perfect, ultra-dense wiring that fiberglass could just never achieve.
Okay, that covers the wiring.
Right. Then, to solve the distance issue, they stop laying the memory chips flat.
What do they do instead?
They stack the memory dies vertically, one on top of the other, just like a skyscraper.
Okay, going vertical makes sense to save space on the board. But how do the memory chips sitting at the very top of the skyscraper actually transmit data down to the processor at the bottom?
That is done through a process that genuinely sounds like science fiction.
I'm ready.
They drill microscopic copper pillars. They're called through silicon vias, or TSVs, straight down through the vertical stack of chips.
Wait, they're drilling right through the fragile silicon dies?
Straight through them. Going vertical allows these pins to connect directly downward into the processor's grid, completely bypassing the need to fan out horizontally.
That's unbelievable.
They take this entire memory skyscraper and just bolt it directly onto the roof of the GPU itself, sitting right on that polished silicon interposer.
Drilling microscopic holes through pure silicon just to thread copper wire. That sounds incredibly fragile and, frankly, incredibly expensive.
Oh, the cost is staggering. If you look at one of the top-tier AI setups, like the GB300 server node, one of these nodes holds over a full terabyte of HBM.
A terabyte.
Yeah. And the cost for just one node is roughly 2 million RMB.
2 million RMB for a single server node, that is.
Wow.
And here's the kicker. The processing chip, like the GPU itself, isn't even the most expensive part of that price tag.
Really?
Nope. The overwhelming cost is that multi-story lump of HBM sitting on its roof and the ridiculously complex engineering required to stack it and drill it without shattering the silicon.
So what does this all mean? I mean, huge tech companies are clearly willing to buy these 2 million RMB server nodes. Mm-hmm. But how does this impact, you know, you, the listener, who might just be trying to build a normal workstation for your house?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it actually impacts the entire supply chain. The fabrication plants that manufacture these ultra-expensive HBM skyscrapers are the exact same factories that build ordinary main memory.
Oh, so the leaky buckets and the multi-million dollar skyscrapers share a production line.
Exactly, they share the same floor. And right now, AI companies are buying up massive amounts of manufacturing capacity to build their HBM. They're essentially buying out the factory floor.
Right.
Because the factories are so busy building AI skyscrapers, ordinary memory gets pushed to the side.
Supply drops and basic RAM gets pricier.
Exactly. So if you paid a premium on your last standard memory upgrade, you were, in a very real way, partly footing the bill for the massive AI boom.
That is just taking a step back and looking at this whole journey. It's incredible.
It really is.
Like, we started with this flawed foundation, a single capacitor and a transistor acting like a leaky bucket that constantly forgets what it's holding.
Yeah.
And from that shared DNA, it diverged into two completely different architectural marvels. Main memory became obsessed with latency, perfectly content to drive on a 64-lane road as long as its tiny packages get delivered instantly for the CPU.
Right.
While video memory just ignored latency entirely, building 512-lane highways and inventing multi-level analog cargo trucks just to shove enough freight to feed an army of GPU soldiers.
Yeah, the differing temperaments of the processors literally forced the physical evolution of the memory.
And when even those 512-lane highways weren't enough, VRAM evolved again, just completely abandoning the motherboard to become these vertically drilled multi-million dollar HBM skyscrapers powering the AI revolution.
It's wild to trace it all back.
It makes you look at that stick of RAM and that massive graphics card in your computer completely differently. I mean, they might look like alien technology on their spec sheets, but they share the exact same origin story.
They do. They're just highly specialized physical responses to the unyielding laws of physics.
Which brings up one final thought I want to leave you with. All of these incredible engineering gymnastics we just explored, drilling copper pillars through stacked chips, slicing analog wave amplitudes, polishing silicon to mirror finishes, these are ultimately just humans fighting a desperate war against the physical limits of 2D space.
Yeah, we ran out of room.
Exactly. The electronic data trucks literally cannot drive any faster than the speed of light. Yeah. And on the motherboard, we simply ran out of physical real estate to build more horizontal rows. So just like a crowded, landlocked city, we started building skyscrapers.
Yep.
But what happens when the memory skyscrapers get too tall? We're already bolting the memory directly onto the roof of the processor just to shrink the microscopic distance the data has to travel. Are we approaching a future where the very concept of separate memory disappears entirely? Will the processors and the memory eventually merge into one single, inseparable block of silicon functioning just like a human brain?
That's a huge question.
It is. And it's something to mull over the next time you boot up your machine and hear those fans spin up. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the tech around you and keep exploring.